I'm very pleased to welcome our guest speaker tonight, Mr. Salim Lohn, who was the senior advisor, or is probably still the senior advisor, to the Prime Minister of Kenya. And he's going to talk tonight about Kenya's pre- and post-election challenges, the end of the Kibaki roller decade. He's been a senior advisor to the Prime Minister of Kenya since 2009. He has previously been Mr. Odinga's spokesman during the turbulent 2007 presidential campaign and the subsequent period of mass post-election violence and the Kofi Annan-led negotiations for an equitable power-sharing agreement. Earlier, Mr. Lohn was a senior United Nations officer at its New York headquarters and became part of Mr. Kofi Annan's core communications team. His latest assignment was as spokesman of the UN mission in Iraq, right after the 2003-led US invasion. Salim, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Machiji. It's really a pleasure to be here. I came out to visit the US and the UK to gather information for the book I'm writing. And the book is primarily about Kenya, domestic Kenya, but there is an international dimension to it. But I've been astounded to see the amount of interest there is in the U.S. and particularly the U.K., which is really quite wonderful. I mean, there is no crisis there to speak of as such at the moment. There was a crisis, and the U.S. and U.K. in particular, and the Europeans actually, were instrumental in helping resolve that crisis of the violence after a very tainted election. But that interest has sort of continued. And in fact, it's been heightened in the last few months because of the next election that's coming up. So it really is very wonderful to see how much interest there is in Kenya. It's not surprising. It's an extraordinary place. Britain, in particular, has a long association with it, some not so good and some quite wonderful. So it's good to see that you're still engaged. Now, it's customary to say that every election, before every election, is a crucial one. And it's true. I mean, every election is crucial because it determines the fortunes of the country, or at least how the country is governed for the next few years and maybe a decade. But in this particular case, I think we can very strongly say that this election is very, very, very important. And the reason is because there is a fear that if this election does not go well, it will have very long-term implications. Kenyans, since 2002, when they voted out the Moi regime, have been consistently betrayed, despite the extraordinary level of, you know, democratic openness that we have. And in 2002, as you all know, what seemed to be a very strong national team, which had helped defeat the Moi-supported candidates, suddenly withdrew into like a tribal cocoon and alienated a big chunk of the Kenyan leadership, which had helped the Kibaki administration win. And we saw in 2005 then the government lose a referendum, and it lost it very heavily, 7 provinces to 1. So again, Kenyans thought, oh, this is great. I mean, we've been able to defeat the government for a second time, and now there will be some changes. But instead, the government turned inwards again, became even more, drew the wagons, and became even more insular. Then we had other very open and democratic campaign for the 2007 election, and then all of you know what happened again. I mean, the people had elected Raila, really. I mean, I can't prove it here, but I think most people know that Raila comfortably won the election. And then in 2010, a constitution was passed by Kenya, an extraordinary constitution. And once again, after that, what they saw was efforts to undermine that very constitution. So again and again and again, Kenyans in the last 10 years have seen themselves vote for things they wanted and seen that not happen. So if there is a tainted election this time, I just fear. I mean, I think there'll be a long period of unrest. Many people will give up their faith in the democratic process and turn to other means. At the same time, if a tainted election results in the victory, so to speak, of a group of people who are committed to the so-called status quo, then inevitably they will have to practice much more repression, because Kenyans after 10 years have become used to sort of having their way and will not accept anymore the kind of suppression and repression that had existed, certainly very openly until the Moi years and in more qualified ways since then. So we really, really need to have a good election. And I just want to say the obvious, a lot of interest in the election in terms of the violence, that we must avoid the violence. But please go beyond the violence. I mean, a very important group in the U.S., when I was there, issued a statement just expressing concern about the violence and how to avoid it. I mean, we have to ensure that the election is fair, we meaning we Kenyans, with some help from our friends, because there are causes for violence. Violence doesn't come out of the blue. But even if we get a fair election and a popularly elected winner, I think it will not be easy for the new regime, even a democratically elected popular one. Because the reason we have so many problems in Kenya, one reason, is because for 50 years next year, we have had the same elite, slightly reformulated under the Moi regime, but in essence the same regime, same elite in power, controlling sort of the vast power and wealth of the country. And this is one of the issues I want to address in the book. How does change come about in a society when the power is all on one side for 50 years? You know, virtually every country I know has had some breaks, some coup, some genocide. In other words, things are broken up, you know, some secessions. But Kenya has not had, except for the very terrible violence in 2007 and 8, which in fact by normal standards was minimal, you know, when you look at what happened in Rwanda, etc., DRC, Somalia, Ethiopia. So this is a very big issue for Kenya, meaning even with a popularly elected president, will we be able to make the reforms that the Constitution promises, and which are just absolutely essential for Kenya, if Kenya is to live as a democratic, peaceful country. Now, while I'm emphasizing right now the worries we have, the fact is that under the Kibaki administration in the last 10 years, we've had extraordinary achievements. I mean, Kenya, in any event, even under Moi, when there were so many difficulties, its people are very open, they're very democratic, they want to live in peace, they engage with the outside world very well. But we have seen real progress on the economic front. The economy has grown, even though poverty has also increased at the same time. But there were some extraordinary achievements in the last 10 years. And I want to focus just briefly on those since the election in the coalition government. For one, we had Africa's first grand coalition. And I'm sorry if I'm going to mention some of the things that some of you might know, but I've discovered often that when I travel and talk to people outside Kenya, including at government offices, there is a different perception of some issues from the ones I and many other Kenyans have. So this was an extraordinary grand coalition, and its greatest impact was that for the first time, we had a government that represented every inch of Kenya. I mean, it came at the cost of having 42 ministries, but it was a government that represented the people. And it also saw, not just at the ministerial level, but it saw people, Kenyans, cooperate on a whole variety of fronts. So this was an extraordinary achievement, and the result in the end was that we passed numerous laws, we established numerous commissions, dealt with the problems with the Electoral Commission. Justice Waki did an extraordinary, courageous report on what had happened in the violence. And the culmination of it was, of course, the Constitution. The Constitution that we adopted in 2010, by far the most widely consultative process in the world, probably, certainly in Africa. And at its heart were three or four items that will make a huge difference if they are implemented. One is devolution. As you know, in Kenya, the greatest challenge apart from, well, it's related to ethnicity, apart from ethnicity, is division and marginalization of groups. And under devolution, a very popular subject in most parts of Kenya, this, if implemented well, will begin to change. And people will feel that they have control over their destinies, not merely in terms of what budgets will come to them, but what they feel are their priorities and how they should meet them. Then we have a Bill of Rights, which is enforceable under the laws. I mean, Bill of Rights are not too uncommon, but one enforceable under the laws of Kenya, this was a huge improvement. Then we have an integrity chapter for leadership, which is unique in Africa. No other constitution in Africa has an integrity chapter about the leaders, the kind of backgrounds leaders must have, or the kind of integrity leaders must have. Then there were the strengthening of institutions, as well as widespread public involvement in senior appointments. For example, our Chief Justice is nominated in a process which includes NGOs. It is not up to the President to decide to name someone who will be approved by Parliament. It is a wide range of people, the Law Society of Kenya, etc. And even the U.S. doesn't have that. I mean, no country in the world has a system whereby the Chief Justice, and, you know, in this particular case, the Chief Justice ended up to be Willy Butunga, whose name I'm sure most of you in this room know, a person who'd suffered for long periods, had been jailed, mistreated, tortured, etc. And for him to be in that office is nothing short of miraculous. But that's the kind of progress we've made in Kenya. An iconic moment in the impact of the new constitution came when the president decided, soon after the constitution was promulgated, to nominate a group of senior officials, Chief Justice, AG, etc., Attorney General, in a manner that was not consistent with the Constitution. And to everyone's delight, even the Chief Justice, who had sworn in President Kibaki, said this is not right, Justice Kishiro. The Minister for Justice said this is not right. A judge said this is not right. Of course, NGOs and many others, Law Society of Kenya. And this is something quite incredible for Kenyans, to see a president being challenged so openly and so universally. First time in Kenya's history, our president was actually defeated on a very big issue that that he considered important. So people really felt that they had achieved something very significant with this constitution. But maybe they became too complacent, those who wanted reform, those who wanted change, thinking we've got it made. And so what happened at the political level was a lot of leaders who were identified as being pro-reform, they began to do the normal political maneuvering before elections after that, and sort of lost the plot in terms of how to keep the people engaged in how this constitution could make them do better. And in that complacency and in ceding sort of ground to the other side, we saw the anti-reformers emerge very sharply. And the process began just before the constitution was adopted, in the run-up of the referendum. And for weeks and months, those opposed to the constitution had a field day, because they were leading in the news, they were leading on newspapers and television, while the people who had supported change and reform were sort of silent. it allowed the forces resisting change to regroup that complacency and that ceding of the ground. Now, the constitution had only passed because both Raila and President Kibaki, Raila Odinga, the Prime Minister, and President Kibaki had supported it. If Raila was known to support it anyway, he'd been fighting for a new constitution for a long time, but President Kibaki's support was most welcome because without it, that constitution could not have passed. So these anti-reform forces who sort of began just before the constitution to mobilize then got had their field day with the ICC. In December 2010, the names of those who would be tried at The Hague were announced, and we saw a dramatic shift in political allegiances and alliances immediately afterwards. Those who were accused, they led what you would see neutrally as a very brilliant campaign in turning many Kenyans into thinking this ICC was a foreign imposed project designed to, you know, serve the interests of the West. And they said so openly. And they were able to convince many, many people. That momentum grew. For example, Uhuru Kenyatta, one of the presidential candidates, who was one of the suspects and subsequently one of the accused, became a leader in Central Province, while before his naming, he was one of those fighting to become the Central Province leader. I mean, in our country, as you know, you have to have the support of your own community before you go on to higher things. So he very quickly, through a very good campaign, became the leader of Central Province. I don't mean there were no challenges, but he no longer had to struggle the way he was before. The ICC has caused some problems for the UK as well, because some months back, last year, Mr. Hague made a remark which was interpreted to mean that the UK would not be keen to have those who were named by the ICC to run for the presidency. What complicated matters was that he felt obliged when there was a storm of criticism from those who were named about foreign interference. There was a clarification issued after that. At the same time, it seemed that this pronouncement by Mr. Hague was not coordinated with other friends of Kenya, international friends of Kenya, because no one else spoke. And soon, as you know, there was this dossier produced, which was clearly fabricated without any question. And yet many people came to believe it, because it seemed like the British, during the Mau Mau days, they prosecuted Jomo Kenyatta, and now they were going after the son. And in the dossier, there was one particularly inflammatory element, which was that after President Kibaki steps down, there were plans to ensure that he would also be taken to the ICC. You know, the ICC was painted as a Western plot to defeat a particular section of the government and population. So these were very, very big reversals in Kenya. Soon after, we thought things would go much, much better. We really thought this was an irreversible process. And so what we've seen now is that parts of the Constitution are being undermined. And one of the key issues here is the integrity chapter that I mentioned earlier. Under the Constitution, everyone is considered innocent until proven guilty. And of course, only after they've exhausted all their appeals. But, and we all thought the integrity chapter would ensure no one who was up before the ICC or a major court like that would be allowed to run. But now the thinking is, amongst many people, no, that's not correct. If they have not been convicted and gone through all the appeals, they can run. So I'm not a constitutional lawyer. I have no idea how the courts will interpret the Constitution. But the reality is that the integrity chapter has become meaningless. If you have to be convicted of a major crime and exhaust your appeals, which can take even a decade in Kenya, it means the integrity chapter has no meaning. Then we have seen, for example, reforms in various institutions that are so important, and they're particularly important in the police, because most Kenyans, the one institution they have contact with most of all is the police. But those reforms have been completely stalled for a long time. And it is possible that they will not be completed before the election. I think all of you know by now that there is a lot of ethnic incitement, hate speech, etc. So some of the appointments are very, very ethnic. So along with all the great progress we've made, there are these other concerns. So what's the net result of all of this? I don't speak for Raila anymore, by the way. I was, of course, a senior advisor, but since I began this trip, I have limited my contact because the book will preoccupy me. I mean, we're still friends and I talk to him. But certainly everybody will agree that he's known to have fought for reform over the years. Whatever you think of him now, certainly over the decades, he's fought for, sacrificed for reform. And we have seen how he has begun to reach out to some who are clearly not in the reform movement. It obviously means that he has decided that it is not possible to win the presidential election unless you make an alliance with non-reformers. And bizarre as that might sound, the fact is that it's not merely the election. After the election, if you do want to bring change, how are you going to do it if the very powerful elite is all opposed to you? So without saying that Raila is doing the right thing, not at all, I mean, that's an issue for each one of us to decide, the fact that he has felt the need to reach out to the anti-reformers, seemingly it seems to former President Moi, is again a sign of how complicated the situation in Kenya is. There's just a growing belief that however strong you are as a reformer, you will not have the support from Kenyans. And the issue, the reason is quite simple, that ethnic identity has been manipulated so strongly by politicians that has undercut every other common ground that reform had. So it's a huge blow. How do you bring about change when there is such a strong elite, which is not right to give up power? In fact, President Kibaki's sort of slogan in the last election was Kazi Endelea, meaning we will continue working as we have been, meaning you don't need any fundamental change. And Uhuru said a few days ago that reform has been accomplished. Why is Raila talking about reform? So there's a group of people who actually believes that you don't need any more reforms. I mean, I don't agree with that, but many Kenyans, they rally ethnically behind their leaders, and whether they're for reform, which would help them or not, that's how it is in Kenya at the moment. And there has, I often say about foreign involvement that you have to be very, very careful. I mean, the West doesn't have that much influence in Kenya. And thank God, because you want Kenyans to manage their own affairs. But the West does have a role. And that role should be used judiciously. Am I running out of time?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. No, I'm so sorry. Okay, I'll end in 2 minutes. Okay. So what's my message to all of you here is your governments, I mean, you know, outside Kenya now, must do your best to support the reform process. Many of you are doing that, but there's been a huge vacuum. The Americans have been very quiet. You didn't have a high commissioner there for the last 6 months. You're an acting High Commissioner. So I'll answer questions if there are any. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Salim. Thank you.